We're so glad that you're here this morning. Welcome to Highland Park United Methodist Church. I know that many of you, this is your church home, but I also know that some of you are here this morning specifically for this event. And we're so glad that you're here this morning. We hope you find this to be a welcoming, hospitable church. So this is our Parent Quarterly. Four times a year, we gather parents together to talk about issues that we know that parents in this community are interested in because you tell us that you're interested in these issues. So we gather parents together to talk about key issues that, frankly, the youth staff is just not equipped to talk about. So we bring in experts to speak on these things. This is a part of our larger family ministry initiative. We rolled out at the beginning of this school year our vision, our strategy to partner with parents. And what we hope to see is the church and the home partner together to create environments that help the teenagers and the children in this community to grow up to be disciples of Jesus. We are still building that out. And there are a few key topics that we know that parents really want help in, and they want the church to be partnering with them in. And one of those areas is sexuality. And we're going to be building that out over the next couple of years. We're going to continue to try to be a leading church in this community on partnering with parents on this issue. I have two little boys myself. One is a four-year-old and one is a seven-month-old, and I already need help. Boyd, our four-year-old, is already asking me questions. So we're going to continue to build that out. But we're really glad that you're here this morning. Before we get started, I want to let you know about just a couple of things. One is, one of the key things that we feel like all families should consider doing is sending their teenagers on a mission trip. So many of you have sent your kids on a mission trip. How many of your kids have been on a mission trip? Yeah, many, many of you. Mission trips are truly life-changing experiences. If you haven't had the opportunity to send your kid yet, I'm going to encourage you to consider it for this summer. We are going to just outside of New Orleans, Louisiana this summer, July 17th through 23rd, and we're going to be doing hurricane relief down there, still relief from Katrina, and some other things that have happened. So I'm going to encourage you to send your kids on that. Also want to let you know that April 3rd is our next Parent Quarterly. We're going to be welcoming Beth Reeder in to talk about safe conversations and how do we have conversations with our kids. So that's April 3rd, so I hope that you'll go ahead and put that on your calendar. But in just a moment, I'm going to introduce our speaker for this morning. But before I do that, why don't we take a moment to go to the Lord in prayer and ask Him to bless this conversation. Let's pray. Father, we are so grateful that you have brought us here together this morning. And we're grateful for Dr. Suter, for the work that she does on campus, and for the message that she's brought us this morning. I pray that you will speak through her words, and that you will give all of us ears to be able to hear what she's saying. And Lord, I pray that as we walk out of here, we'll be inspired, but that we'll also be equipped to be able to lead our kids and to lead our kids well. God, we're just so grateful that you've created this space for this conversation. We pray these things in the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. Amen. So Dr. Kathy Suter is here with us this morning, and she is over at SMU. She's the Director of Counseling Services, Services for Women, and she's been in this field for 25 years. Is that right? 25 years. She's one of the main therapists on campus working specifically with victims of sexual assault, and she speaks to incoming parents also and students about safety on campus and safety awareness. She's also a longtime member of our church, and she's been in the In His Steps Sunday School class for many, many years. We couldn't be more thankful that she has agreed to be here with us this morning, and I am just trusting and I believe that the words that she has for us this morning could be truly life-changing for us, for our parenting, and for our kids. So would you join me in welcoming Dr. Kathy Suter?
Good morning. Oh my goodness, I hadn't turned around to see how many people had come in. This is great. And I'm looking, there's not a power T. I teach class, and you know what the power T is? The first two rows and all the way back, about two seats in. And so I'm always looking to see who's on the power T. And nobody ever sits on the front row. Even in my class, so what can I do about that? Nothing. I'm really excited to be able to be here to talk to you, to have this really important conversation. Matt mentioned that I speak to incoming parents, and I do that. I have to say that we have a panel of like four or five or six people that we think are key people for parents to hear from as they're considering bringing their student or allowing their student to come to SMU. And so the nurse and I, the director of nursing down in our health center, and I sit on the one end, and we're kind of always the last ones to go. And everybody gets nice applause and claps for all the things that they're talking about. And then we come up, And first of all, they're wanting to know about medical care, which is great, right? And then they hear my thing, which is, you know, if your child needs counseling, if you have these kinds of issues, you know, pre-diagnosis, I do sexual assault, you need to be aware of Title IX. I never get applause, never. Now, I think I'm a decent speaker, but I'm just here to tell you that the look on the parent's face is kind of glazed over. So I'm hoping that you'll take a deep breath and hang on, because this will be a difficult conversation to some of us and to all of us, because this is not something that we routinely go and hear a lecture about, unless you're taking a class in human sexuality someplace. So I've got a little cheat sheet here that I'm going to use, and I'm hoping that this will be helpful to me as we move forward. I hope, oh, there is a clock up there. I didn't know whether there, we used to meet in here in our Sunday school class. I wasn't sure there was a clock. All right, so I'll try to get you out at 10:30. Is that my time? Yeah? Okay, thanks. I'm sorry, there's a class that comes. Okay. Well, you'll put a high sign up if I talk too long. All right, so I know all of you are here as concerned parents. You wouldn't be here if you weren't. And I think the role that you play in your children's life, and I'm going to put step back here so I can take a look at this, the role that you play in your children's lives is one of what I like to call launching and anchoring. Now, it sounds like I've got that in reverse order, right? That it should be anchoring and launching. Are we playing? Sounds like now I'm echoing. Okay. But I do think this notion of launching and anchoring and launching, however you want to think about it, is the way in which you are trying to raise resilient children. Now, resiliency is the big buzzword on college campuses, and you've probably heard it lots of other places as well. And I hope to unpack that as we talk about this subject of the sexuality of your children. Okay? And how many of you have young children, or do we have a nice breadth of how is it middle school? Are we middle school parents, high school parents, soon to be college students, parents? Maybe already have some students in college? Perhaps that's great if you do. All right, well, let's talk a little bit about launching and anchoring. I think all of us, when we have children, are thinking about the notion of goals and dreams for them, helping them to realize their dreams for their present, what's going on currently in their lives, but for their future. And I'm well enough aware of how parents operate. We do plan for our children's future. Some of us more intentionally than others. Some of us have a really picked out road for them, and others of us are vaguer about our dreams, if you will. But we do that. We hope to have their backs, to keep them grounded, anticipate. How many of you are anticipators and planners? Yes, most of us. You keep your list, you've got a goal in mind, you know where you're headed. And I think one of the big things as parents is to anticipate their needs, their wants, situations that might be dangerous for them, right? Things that they may need along the way. And to see those things and be able to react, or perhaps the better word would be to respond. I think of reaction as that thing where you just go, you know, and then you react. And a response is what? Hopefully your brain's kicked in, you took a deep breath, and you have a little bit or more oxygen to be able to respond to the situation that's in front of you. And I want to say that I also know that as many people as there are in here, there are different parenting styles. Let me describe one to you. My brother is, about 8 or 9 years younger than I, and he married late. He did everything late, but he was marrying late. And his friends gave he and his soon-to-be wife a wedding shower. And so we were at a house where the couple had just had a baby. And I think that Graham was probably walking, so he was just, you know, doing that crawly thing and holding on to things. You know how kids do. And I walked in, a beautiful home, all white marble, all white carpet. Clearly they had not planned well for the birth of a child, or this was already in place and they had not yet done the decorating or redecorating that they were going to need to do. But what struck me as I walked into their living room is that the entire place, all of the sharp corners, all of things like this, were bubble wrapped. And I mean, they were bubble wrapped to an nth degree. There was not one hard surface in that whole entire house that did not have a piece of bubble wrap on them. And it was beautiful bubble wrap, too. And if you're a bubble wrap popper, you know how I had to keep my hands behind my back the whole time I was in the house not to pop the bubble wrap. And so at some point in time, you know, I'm a curious person, psychologist by trade. So I was very curious about why they had bubble wrapped the house. And so I asked, finally. I just couldn't stand it. And the husband said, or the father said, oh, you know, we had it bubble wrapped for Graham. And he said, do you want the name? And I'm thinking, well, I think my kids are past the bubble wrap stage, but no, thank you. But he said, and I said, so what's your purpose? And he said, well, we just don't want him to get hurt. Now, how many of you have felt like bubble wrapping your children? Yeah, I mean, I feel like it, and mine are way older, and I have grandchildren. And if I could bubble wrap the grandchildren, I would as well. But that's how we feel, don't we? We just think, if I could just cocoon them for just a little while. Life is so hard. Life is tough. I want them to be safe. And bubble wrap would indeed, when it pops, would let me know that they're in trouble and I could come do what? Save them. So bubble wrap parents all the way up to and including those parents who sort of drop them off at the door of college, tell them, when you come home, let me know because we've made your room into the workout room. And that has truly happened, by the way. And you may want to let us know so we can find you a place to sleep. You know, those kind. So it runs the gamut of parenting styles and how we're going to handle it. But I will say this. What I think is really important, of course you're going to imagine that I'm going to say this, is to pick some kind of middle ground and build resiliency. How many of you think about successfully failing in connection with your child? Is that ever a phrase you've ever thought about? Because we do need to provide them with an atmosphere for trial and error learning, to successfully fail at things in order to do what? To fit them for life. I don't know about you, but life is not, there's no helicopter parent for you after a certain amount of time, and I'm not suggesting that you guys are that. Nor do I suggest that you're bubble wrap parents. But I know what's in our hearts. And what's in our hearts is that we want to do the very best that we can for our children. But we don't do them the best if we shield them from all sorts of hurts and bumps and scrapes. And indeed, those scars that you get, and perhaps you have some on your head or your arm or someplace when you fell against a hard surface, whether that's a psychological scar or a physical one, are what? War wounds, aren't they? And you look back at those and remember, and they're helpful to you as an adult to think about how you got through that time. So it's really important for you to be able to think about things in just that way. Now, against this backdrop of this sort of commentary that we've been talking about in terms of your styles as parents, we're going to have a difficult conversation, perhaps. And we're going to do what we've come to do to sort of co-opt Paul, which is what he says in the church service usually. We're going to do what we're going to come to do. We're going to talk about sex, right? So I just really quickly, and I know that I'm not suggesting that you get out a paper and pencil here, but I want you to raise your hand if you're willing to talk about your most recent sexual experience. Am I the only one? I'm not so sure I'm willing either, but I'm pretty clear about my audience. You're not going to charge me, challenge me on this one, and indeed I'm not going to ask. Why don't you want to? Or why didn't anybody raise their hand? Surely you made eye contact this morning with someone. Maybe you kissed them as they left, or you held their hand. And depending on the relationship, is that what? That's can be sexual contact, right? I'm not suggesting foreplay. I'm just talking about, you know, that kind of thing. But why don't we want to talk about it? Anybody? Why didn't you want to talk about it right here? Private. None of my business, as people have been prone to tell me. Who are you to ask me about that? Well, so it's not my business. So what I'm suggesting that we're going to talk about you doing is, once you kind of get a sense of the vocabulary and perhaps a little bit of the lay of the land, is what are you going to do to be able to have these kind of difficult conversations with your children? Because wherever your children are in their process. And at an age-appropriate time, you need to begin, or you need to just be in the process of, first of all, asking their questions. Matt alluded to the four-year-old asking him questions already that he's not sure he has an answer to. And you don't have to give them the whole thing. You just have to answer that first question, right? And if they're curious and they're able to do it, they will ask you a next question. I do remember the time my daughter in the car, and carpool is a wonderful thing, isn't it? You can really, I mean, they will say things in the car that you just cannot believe. And I don't remember how old she was, but she asked me about wet dreams. And, of course, I'm choking it down and thinking, where did you hear about wet dreams? That was my immediate bubble wrap parent reaction, right? But you do have to have an answer for those. So you take a deep breath, get oxygen to the brain. There's no point in acting in the fight or flight syndrome. Just take a deep breath, get your brain going, and answer that question without, where did you hear about that? So we are. You don't want to talk about it. I don't want to talk about it, but we are going to. So let me say this. The culture that we live in, I don't know about you, but our children and the students that I deal with are sophisticated consumers of this culture. Now, the culture we live in is one of freedom and democracy and craziness and political life and all sorts of things. They have access to a tremendous amount of information, a lot of things. They are sophisticated consumers of this culture. And what I will say about this culture, without getting on a soapbox, is it is highly sexualized. Would you agree? Sex sells in all sorts of ways. And so sexual images are used everywhere. I don't know what that's about. Well, I do know what that's about. It sells. That's what it's about. And so what I know is that we sexualize our children very early. Now, what does that mean, to sexualize our children very early? I'm not saying that you do it. I'm just saying our culture does it. But the impact that it has on a child is that somewhere or the other, they grow up thinking that a person's value is predicated on their sexual appeal and their behavior to some degree or the other. Coupled with that is that a person's value has something to do with their physical attractiveness. Well, those are kind of, I don't know how we get away from that living in the culture in which we live, but that's the way it is. And that is the way many of us think about ourselves and live in our own culture. That's sort of how we take in that culture. But it leads to two more things that I think are worrisome. It leads to the person becoming objectified so that you become an object to someone else. Okay? Not a subject of your own life, but an object. And that in certain circumstances, your sense of personhood can be inappropriately imposed upon. So we teach our children about danger, stranger danger, and things of that nature, and good touch and bad touch. We have all sorts of ways in which we start these conversations early with our kids. Now, I'm going to say another, one hyphenated word and another word, the hookup generation. How many of you know about the hookup generation? You may know about it. How many of you think you're well educated about it? Well, I think you know. I've been working at SMU now 26 years, and I'm here to say that I am not well educated on the hookup generation. Although I see them and talk to them day after day after day after day, and also sit on a number of committees that takes a look at behavior of students that we become concerned about. And I think none of us have a real handle on it, but let me give it a stab as to kind of talk about it. So what does that mean? Well, it does mean, what do students do when they come to college? What do students do when they go to high school? They're looking to fit in. They're trying to fit into the social scene. They're reading it. Everybody sort of knows how to do school, right? They've been in academic. They've been sitting behind a class, you know, a table and being in a classroom for a very long time. So they sort of have some idea of what school is like. But when they come to school away from home and in a different setting, they're also looking to fit in. The whole person goes. So not just the academic student side of that person, but the whole person comes. And they're seeking to fit in. So they want friends. They're thinking about possible romances. Now I'm talking about high school and college, maybe even middle school. Dating. Okay, so do we think the hookup generation has some kind of difficulty here accommodating dating? And we think, how many of you all dated in high school and college? Many of you, most of you, and at some point, yeah. All right. Well, what I know about the hookup generation is that it can mean a lot of different things. So it's best to ask. And, of course, that's, again, what I do for a living is lots of questions. And so I ask, well, what do you mean when you say you guys hooked up? What does that mean to you? And sometimes that just means making out. I won't ask you to raise your hands about making out. You've already shown me that you're not going to raise your hands to certain questions, and I assume that's one of them. But probably everybody enjoyed a make-out session. You know, that's just part of human nature and human life, so we enjoy that kind of thing. So it can be just that you hooked up. I will say that colleges and maybe even high school, and you may be finding this, that there's not as much dating going on. They tend to hang out in groups. They have sometimes a very well-defined group, and we'll talk about that in a minute, but a well-defined group with whom they hang. It's a group of students and kids and friends that you probably feel comfortable with them spending time with. And so you're okay with them going and sort of hanging with that group. In college, that hanging out can mean that they're just hanging out and having a good time. Oftentimes, it's paired with what? Substance use. I'm not saying necessarily abuse, but some of these do involve substance abuse. So hooking up culture has along with it this kind of history of some kind of use of substances, whether that's alcohol, whether that's marijuana, weed, lots of different ways in which students sort of pair these activities together. So they have these gatherings, these parties, these hanging out times. They're small or they're large. And oftentimes we find that they're spending time together or they pair up, and the pairing up is then often involved in the making out. But it can also be they pair up for a one-night stand, which is, to be quite frank, if you just want to be really honest, a hookup is just a one-night stand. This is a kind of an immediate sexual liaison that's going to happen. We hope that it's consensual. Keep that one in the back of your head. We hope that it's consensual, and it is not intended to be saying yes to a relationship. Now, I did ask a student one time, what did it mean to say yes to this, whatever she was talking about? And she said, well, I thought I was saying yes to a relationship. You need to be sure, and your students need to be sure, what they're saying yes to, if they're able to say yes or give consent. So is it a one-night stand? And oftentimes students will tell me, well, this is how dating begins. You don't know if you want to date somebody until maybe you've had sex with them. And I'm thinking, oh, that's not the way I learned it, you know, and probably not the way you guys learned it necessarily, but that is sort of the general consensus of, we're going to see how this works, and we may graduate to friends with benefits. Heard that phrase? So that you're friends and spend a lot of close time together and you snuggle and then things happen sometimes and it becomes that. And then and only then might you decide that this relationship is worthy of a being together. They would never say dating, we're dating. They would just be together. And so it's important that you kind of get a sense of the logic. Sometimes students will tell me, I say, are you dating anybody? And they kind of look at me. And I say, well, are you together with anybody? And then I said, they will say, well, we're talking. Well, what that means is they're not really talking. They're texting. But they're talking, right? But it's not face-to-face. Okay? They're just talking. They're texting. And this is how a lot of relationships begin. So they get together, they hang together, they spend time together, maybe it's a group that's comfortable for them, they feel confident in this group, and confidence often masquerades as trust. They think they trust them because they feel confident in this setting. So they move into this sort of attitude of, well, we're just going to see how this works out. Combined with substance abuse, this is what? Do we think that this is lethal? Well, it may not be lethal, but it is certainly risky. Because they are, to some degree or the other, and not all of your students are drinking. Many of them have chosen not to drink, but some are. Some have made very good decisions already about their sexual activity and what they're invested in. But what I am talking about, and this is what I suggest to the students at SMU, that you begin as early as it is possible to begin to have conversations that are open-ended and non-judgmental. Now, it is really hard sometimes to, and I have to say that, as I said, I have two daughters, and when they call, even to this day, and they will say, Mom, you know, they have that note in their voice, you know how that is, and you kind of pick up on that note. And I said, what is it? And they said, well, now you talk to you. And I said, well, okay, which hat do you want? Do you want mom hat? Do you want friend hat? Do you want psychologist hat? Because I have been in those situations where my daughters would call me, and whatever it is I say, they would say, well, that's not very mom-like. Or I just want a friend. Or that is really not very psychologically astute, Mom, which is something someone said to me recently. And I finally just told her, look, when you call me, just know that, yes, I can be your friend. Yes, I am your mom, and I am your psychologist, not. But I am, first of all, your parent, and that's the lens through which I'm going to talk with you, so I don't have to be a good psychologist when I'm talking with you. Those are just some asides, but you know how it is. What I'm worried about and what I see is this climate of confidence that gets, that we want our students to be confident. We want our children to be confident, don't we? We want them to feel like they can manage life, that they can work through it, that everything is going well. And at the same time, we also want them to be what? Aware, vigilant, those kinds of things, aren't we? Don't we want that? We do want them to be that, but we also don't want them to be cravenly afraid. Either. We want, because we know what that is like. We don't want them to be highly anxious about what's going to happen to them. But I will say that the way in which things happen, and what I am really stunned over the last 10 years, I guess probably the most stunning thing that's been, is that students now drink as their activity. So I don't know whether you're, how aware you are of this, but the activity is not going down someplace, going to a game and having a couple of beers after or a couple of drinks after the game or maybe having a pre-party. The activity, the thing they get together for is to get drunk, is to get hammered, wasted, all of those whatever phrases that you can talk about. So when we talk about sexuality and a situation where the hooking up generation is active out there and you talk about young men and women, adolescent men and women, hesitant to say boys and girls because that's not what they are, but you get together with them and you begin to wonder, what are they really thinking and how are they thinking about all of these situations that they're going to find themselves in? Because whether or not they choose to drink, they're going to be what? They're going to be exposed to alcohol and drugs. They're going to be exposed in their residential commons, in their residential halls, in any kind of party they attend, and they're going to have to figure out how they're going to manage and handle that. Because the one thing or the several things that they're after when they go to college is what? New friends. You guys have talked about your college life, I bet, to them and told them how wonderful it was. They are expecting to make lifelong friends into college, and indeed many of them will. They're not thinking about this being a place where they need to protect themselves, but having conversations with them about that are open-ended, and this is the most important part. They start off with this kind of mutual respect, and they start off with a caveat from you of you're not going to fall apart if they have something to tell you that they are fearful you won't like. Now, that's what I'm, when I talk about that difference between reaction and responding, This is where the training needs to begin for you guys. And you've already are probably pretty good at this, but I think when we're thinking about sexuality, when we're thinking about substance use, all of these things that are such hot challenges for our children and our grandchildren, these are things that you need to begin to have conversations, but they're not going to talk with you if you're what? If they can already be sure you're going to be pretty judgmental, pretty much on their case immediately. Talk to a ton of students who have been in situations where to have talked with their parents would have served them well. And when I ask them why they haven't, they said, oh, I just don't think they could take it. And I said, well, I bet you they're much stronger than you think they are. One of the most outstanding young women I worked with pretty early on in my career at SMU, working particularly with sexual assault, had been at a party, was sexually assaulted at that time. She knew she had had too much to drink. And when I went to meet, I used accompanied to the hospital. So I went to meet her at the hospital, and she was getting ready for an exam. And I said, is there anybody you want me to notify? Do you want me to notify your parents? And she said, oh, I've already called them. And I said, you have? And she said, yeah, I have. And I said, well, that's great. What led you to be able to do that? Oh, she said, oh, I always knew that if something happened to me, I would report it. And I always knew that I would call my parents and involve them. I said, why? They said, we've just talked about this a lot. And there's just nothing that I'm going to go through that they don't want to be a part of. What a great attitude she had. Now, did things go well? It was a tough time for her. Her parents were in. It was a difficult situation. But she never for one moment doubted that her parents were not going to be able to manage whatever problem she felt she had. And that is the confidence that you want to give your children. The other confidence that you want to give them is that you really are in the business of building resiliency in them. And you expect them to trial and error a life. You expect them to fail successfully. And failing successfully is to do what? How many of you have done this? Most of us can think of a million times that the things that happened to us that were the most difficult are also what? Our biggest opportunities for growth. So we can have these shipwreck experiences, but because we have a habit of dialogue with our child, of talking out about anything, they are able to have confidence in you. And that is really, really important. One of the loveliest things one of my daughters ever said to me, she said, you know the best thing about you, Mom? And I was like, oh, it's going to be something grand. And she said, you never flinch. Now, I don't know that I think that's a goal that you as a parent want to have, you know, because it's just what it is. But I thought, well, that's probably true. And she said, there's just nothing that rocks your world. I said, wrong. Lots of things rock my world. But I'm not going to necessarily let you see the rocking of my world until you know you have somebody that has your back, that you're safe. And so these are the things that we want to think about. Resiliency, down the line, is the way in which we keep our children safe. Being able to know that if something happens and they get knocked down and the bubble wrap is not there, that they have themselves to rely on, but that they equally as importantly have you to rely on. And most of them are, when they talk about this, are afraid that parents are going to overreact, bring them home from school, and not let them continue their life as they know it to be. Or they're going to blame them or be angry with them. And I'm not saying there's not a proper time for anger. I'm not saying there's not a proper time for firm boundary. There is in all of these situations. But certainly you want to foster the kind of dialogue, again, with your son or daughter that allows you to discuss mutual respect, not only with them and you, but mutual respect for the people that they will be involved with, whether that's someone they might be in a relationship with, whether that's their friend, but that there's this mutual respect that goes on. And that being in a relationship without that is not a good relationship at all. And the other thing that we're finding, and it is about sexuality, because I do think the relationships that we find ourselves in that have this kind of partnership where sex is involved also leads to staying in relationships that are harmful. We have seen a huge rise, I think, in courtship violence or intimate partner violence is the way we talk about it now, at SMU. And I think that's a growing problem in colleges. And these students oftentimes come from their high schools with this kind of relationship, not necessarily physical abuse, but certainly some psychological abuse, where somebody has been in complete control of a relationship. So having a conversation with them that allows for that discussion of their value systems, and it's important for them to know what you believe, right? But it's also important for you to know what they believe. Where are they on these important topics? What do they think about it? And are they willing to kind of talk with you about those? Now, I'm not saying that that's going to be done with, oh, goody, we're going to get to have that kind of talk with our parents. It won't be. They will roll their eyes. They will be resistant to some extent. But that doesn't mean if you come at them with this kind of respect attitude, they're going to be okay with you engaging in that kind of dialogue. So what can you do now? well, this is what you can do now. You can begin to have that kind of conversation. In the midst of all of these sort of circumstances where students come together and find themselves in risky situations, can they call you any time of the day or night? Do they have access to you? Would you, no questions asked, send an Uber or make sure that they know how to get home? These kinds of things. Do they have that assurance in their that backs them up, that allows you to launch and to anchor them? You know what you do with when the hurricanes come? Do you know what the big seagoing vessels do when a hurricane comes and if they're in port? Anybody? They go to sea. And why did they go to sea? They're going to drop anchor, and they're going to ride out a hurricane in what? In a long lead, in a deep anchor. And that is what as you grow older and your children's mature, this is what you want to be for them. You want to be the person that they come to you for as a friend, as a mom and a dad, but you also want them to come to you because they know they can ride out any storm in deep anchor with you. And that's that assurance that you want to provide for them. Because I'm here to tell you that oftentimes what happens when someone gets involved in a sexual relationship or an intimate relationship that involves some kind of abuse or harm is their lives get hijacked for a period of time. And you don't want that to happen. You want them to be able to, it'll be difficult, but you want them to be able to come to you and talk about those issues. Sometimes these groups that they get involved in, and I often think about, and we hear this word a lot about date rape and acquaintance rape, and those are the things that we're most afraid of. Actually, I think a more, probably a better and more accurate term is a confidence rape, because sexual assault, and that is simply what? A sexual assault is simply sex without consent. So what would you want to include in any kind of conversation you might have with your son or daughter about how they're going to manage their sexual lives? Well, you would want to talk about consent. You would want to talk about their own value system. You would want to come at them with those kinds of concerns and give them an opportunity to ask their questions of you in a private session, so they don't feel like they're talking with their friends about this, by the way. This is something that friends talk about now. Middle school, high school, college, they're all talking about it. So these are not conversations they haven't or had already. They have. They just maybe haven't had them in a full discussion with you. And you may never get a lot of participation from them in it. That's okay. You're also doing what? You're building that situation of mutual respect and access. And that's what you want to be able to do. So you're cultivating the atmosphere of respect. And what do we do when we cultivate? You dig around in the soil. You make sure it's ready. You plant the plant deep. You water it. You take care of it. And it takes what? Time. And so this will not be done overnight. It's going to take a lot of time and interest and commitment from you as parents to engage in this kind of dialogue with them. Find out what's important to them. Cultivate conscious decision-making in them. Have you thought about where this will take you? Someone wise to me one day said, just take what you're thinking right now and push it out to its final conclusion. Is that where you want to go? It's a really important statement for kids to get a hold of. Just push it out. Is this going to take you where you want to go? And those are the kinds of conversations that you want to have, not necessarily about when and where and under what circumstances you might decide to become sexually active, although those may be important. But these are the kinds of things that allow you to create that atmosphere of openness. And you want them to understand consent. Sexual assault is nothing more than sex without consent. Someone touching you sexually without your informed consent. If you've had too much to drink, can you give consent? Difficult, hard. And so having sex while you're drinking or using, man or woman, young man or young woman, whomever it is, leads to a situation that can be misunderstood and where consent can't possibly be given. So again, making sure that they understand what consent is about. and how they would go about saying no, how they would be able to manage that if they were in a situation they didn't want to be in. What to do if, and maybe you have to play out that scenario, they've been exposed to an STI. That can happen. I work in a college counseling center, but on the first floor is what? Our health center. So I'm pretty aware of what goes on. They may become pregnant if it's a girl. What will you do, and how will you handle that, and what will go on with that? Help them to think through some of those scenarios. Again, the sexual misconduct, however that applies, or inappropriate conduct of some sort, will they feel like they can come to you with those kinds of conversations and those kinds of situations? What you are trying to do, as I've already said, and I've said it several times, so I'm going to just repeat it one more time. As the teacher in me, I find that repetition is what? Golden. So you're creating some space with them for successful failing, but you're also creating community, a sense of, oh, I can come here. And this is a community that starts here, and then a community that moves forward. And they will find not only you as allies, but they will find that there are tons of people in their life that they could also cultivate and grow a bigger community. So sometimes that's really helpful. If you know that there's a particular teacher or somebody at church or someone that they have developed a relationship with that serves sort of as a mentor, you want to encourage them to have those relationships rather than feeling threatened by them. And sometimes we are. If they talk to a beloved aunt or a cousin or a teacher, seemingly they're having more important discussions with them than they are with you. Well, just as you had difficulty raising your hands about your sexual practice this morning with me in this room, your students have that same kind of difficulty, and we don't know what their sexual activity is. It may be making out or holding hands or just really liking somebody and not quite sure what to do with it. But all of that is the beginning of sexuality, isn't it? Sort of making decisions about your sexual activity. And they may be more comfortable talking to someone they don't know well. Ever had deep conversations with a person on a plane that you've never seen, never saw before, and never will see again? Sometimes we will do that, won't we? And so that's important, too, that you create community and the ability for your children to seek out others to be helpful to them. Cultivate gratitude within yourself about your children. I think it's really hard on a daily basis when we're struggling with our kids to be grateful for everything they bring to us. And I just think that's a spirit of gratitude that you want to cultivate on a daily basis. And tell them, I'm just so glad you're my kid. And tell them you're so glad they're your kid during the tough times so that they will know that you really want them to come and that you have faith in them. Let them know that. I have faith that you'll get through this. Let's work it out. Those kinds of statements. Not that you're going to do it all perfectly so you won't be disappointed, but that you have faith in them to be able to handle even the tough times. And so those are really good. Okay, well, I'm talking about the things that you can do with your children. The other thing that I would encourage you to do if you're thinking about schools, not only your colleges where your students might be attending as you're beginning to look at those colleges, but also in your high schools. What do they know about Title IX? I want you to become educated on what Title IX is. Anybody know really quickly? I won't bore you long. Title IX is a letter that, well, actually was a Dear Colleague letter that was sent to high schools and universities stating what they must and must not do with regard to the investigation of sexual assault. We know that sexual assault happens lots of places and ever increasing rates, particularly in our high schools and colleges. And the government, the Office of Civil Rights, the Department of Education, has decided that they want to make sure that there's a standard by which all universities and colleges must live, so to speak, that they don't hide anything, but that they're willing to investigate anything that happens in this area and along this line. So all college representatives, anybody that's a representative of a university or a college, must notify the Title IX coordinator if they know about some kind of domestic violence or intimate partner violence or sexual assault. They must notify. Now, there's only a few places on campus that are not mandated reporters. That would be your college counseling center, your chaplain's office, and some advocates for sexual assault prevention, things of that nature. But be educated as a parent to know that. And if you're thinking about you and your child are having these kind of conversations. These are great conversations to have because they'll know what. In the God forbid time that something would happen, they would know where, what. They would know who to call. They would know how to get help. They would know what's available for them. So be educated. Be educated about their outreach to students. What kind of outreach is that university or college or that high school doing in situations like this? What's their attitude about that? What's our services available if they're in crisis? Make sure that they know those things. And again, this is not you putting into their head that something is going to happen, but that you are providing them with those resources about things that could happen and what to do. We've got about 10 more minutes, so I want to open the floor for questions if anybody has questions. Yes.
I have a lot of daughters, and sometimes they're less inclined to talk about difficult discussions. This one's probably one of the most with me as opposed to my wife. Any suggestions to help the clumsy dads out there to address this?
That is a really great question because I do think dads are hesitant to get involved in things like this, but you've got daughters. I think having those discussions just kind of timidly and quietly initially and just say, you know, I just want to talk to you a little bit about, because you're a guy. You have lots of information that would be helpful to them. So if you have that spirit of openness with them, they may always talk to their mom first, but they will seek you out as well. And what I know from young women who are in college and from young men as well, they really crave relationships with not only their mothers but with their fathers and want that. They seek that out. They may not tell you that, but that's what they want. So again, I think just having those kind of conversations, how is it going, what's important to you. I mean, you can bring in those little value-laden questions without being intrusive, and I think they will appreciate it. And it, like I say, you may never be the first person they come to, but then you may. Yeah, other questions? Yes. So talking about the hookup generation on one side and sexual or substance abuse on the other, how to thread the needle.
Now, what kind of relationship
What should you hope to have? Oh, do you want them to have? Oh, you know, I've had somebody in my office on Friday, and she said, you know, I'm so embarrassed when somebody asks me if I've ever dated. I have to tell them that I haven't. And I'm thinking, well, when would you have had the opportunity? Because they are dating. They're just dating in groups, so to speak. I do think eventually they're going to have that need for privacy, that need to have those kinds of deep, intimate talks with somebody that they're interested in. But they're going to have to be willing to kind of tolerate and set good boundaries for themselves so they won't get sort of siphoned off into something that's unhealthy. And I think sex first, this is just me talking to a group of parents, but I think sex first is not always the best way to start out a healthy, growing relationship. But that's hard to say to your children because they're like, oh, mom, oh, dad, what do you know? I think at the same time, providing them with whatever options they need. I would love it if a child of mine had come to me and said, and I can't say that they did or didn't, I don't want to out them, you know, I'm thinking about becoming sexually active. What do I need to do? Boy, what a great question, but what a great question and what a great relationship that someone has to be able to talk with their parent about that. I have to say that my granddaughter did ask her mom that, and they had it was a really fruitful discussion. So I would say be ever ready to sit up late at night or to talk to them about and to encourage them as early as you can to have mutual respect with the people that they might be hanging out with. This notion of seeing somebody as the subject of their own life rather than as an object or as an end to your means is really important. Yes. Oh, you know, Okay, that's difficult. I think you have to follow your conscience if you are worried. I think a child has a right to privacy. I think sometimes they leave things around in their room because they hope and wish that you would find them. Sometimes they're cries for help. I know that my oldest daughter has an app on her phone that it totally connects her to wherever her three boys are at any time. And they know it. I mean, like, mom, but they know that she's checking from time to time. Now, she would tell you that's from a safety perspective, but it's also from a, I'm just making sure that you're safe and you're not doing anything you're not supposed to be doing safe. And there are two of them are at college. Well, one graduated, but one's at college and one is 14. So she is still in that process. So I don't know. I'm hesitant to tell you to intrude on your son or daughter's privacy. But oftentimes they leave that phone there, and you wonder why they do. Do they want you to pick it up or not? It's just a tough question. And I'm not, anybody got any better answers than that from me? I think it's a case-by-case thing. Yes?
Safety on the Internet. Okay, and I'll be open. My oldest daughter, I trust them. They're very good girls. They don't do too many things bad. But she got into a situation last year where she got pressured by her friends because everybody's using social media. They're not allowed to use social media for that one simple reason, because internet safety is really, really scary. You don't know who, and she had hidden on her phone. She had a Twitter account and some other social media that she knew she was not allowed to have it. And the rule is if you change the code on your phone so I can't look through it, you lose your phone. And they know that. And so she was trying to hide it, and she got caught, and it kind of got pretty hot. And it was like, okay, this is what's going to happen. And she finally came to me and talked to me about it and said, this is what happened, this is what... I do think that she was somewhat innocent in that, other than the fact she did it without asking me. But you really have to be careful, because there were people texting her and emailing her that I have no idea who they are, and they're in other states, okay? And you're talking about a 15-year-old, all right? And it's a reality that it does happen. And somebody can put stuff in your kid's head that you have no idea what's going in there. So I'm an advocate. You may not agree with it, but look through their phone. You own it. You pay for it. It's your phone, okay? Look through it. And if they can't abide by those rules, then that's just, they can't have it. They can't do with it.
Well, and I think this is what I'm talking about in terms of family culture. Every family has a little bit of a different culture, and we kind of have to work out, and our sons and daughters have to work out what it means to grow up in our family. So I set pretty good boundaries for my daughters as well, so I can understand. And I can't say that I never looked at something that my son or daughters left out. I'm sure that I did. I absolutely, confession time, did. But I'm not proud of it when I did, and it was uncomfortable to do it. But I always told my child that I had, you left it out, I looked, I'm sorry, but, and again, that's that successful failing, parents, be able to apologize when you make mistakes as well is wonderful for your children, to be able to be honest about your fears for them is totally understandable. Somebody's got a hand up there and then another one here. Yes. Or not. Maybe a BB gun. You won't. Now, I think in high school you have a little better control because they're going to come and go. And I think it's okay to say you're not going to go spend the night at somebody's house or be with people that I don't know anything about. And I think that's an okay thing. Again, I think you have to decide what your tolerance levels are for situations like that. But it is hard because you're oftentimes not. And they do meet up. Is it Tumblr and some of these apps that where you just, I like your look, let's meet up somewhere? That just sounds absolutely horrible to me. But they are involved in that. They are. And so it's tough. But I think you can start by doing this early on in their dating relationships or their spending time relationships. And then you may have a little more confidence and what they're going to do. But it is a big, scary world. I will just tell you, it is out there. And I don't know that it's any scarier than it ever was, but it feels like it's scarier. Yes. See, I think that's really difficult. We talk about that all the time. And, of course, if it comes to the college level, usually at some point parents are going to be involved. Although, FERPA doesn't allow us to contact parents, in certain circumstances. So if it's an emergency and it's life-threatening, the university has that opportunity to call for the emergency contact person. As a therapist, I'm not allowed. I can notify the police, but I'm not allowed to call a parent. So it's a tough thing, but I think sometimes never underestimate the power of friends. I've talked to a ton of people for whom their friends came, they confronted them, they did that in love and a lot of mutual respect, but that was very helpful to the young person to seek the next step of help that they need and hope that if they will go one place to talk to somebody else, that somebody will refer them someplace else and that perhaps they'll move forward. And more importantly, parents do need to be involved. I will say this, if you start confronting a student who's dating somebody that they're, dead in love with, you know how that is, you remember, and they're not, and you're concerned about the way they're being treated, if you make it about him or her, then you're likely to lose that battle. You need to make it about your relationship with your child. We're concerned. We feel like you don't enjoy being with us. You're not wanting to spend time with us. We see ourselves as a family with a future things, and we are worried that that's not going to be the way it is. And so you can have those kind of conversations. But I think attacking the relationship itself is dangerous water to get into. I'm not saying you shouldn't do it, but I think you have to do it carefully. I think that we do objectify people. I do think this early sort of sexualization, I think when we see people as objects, we are only going to be as good to them as our beneficence at that time allows for. It is in the culture. We see it everywhere. And so I do think the violence is terrifying. Yes. The three B's. Well, it's such a good question. Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, and I totally agree. I do think we have to hold our nerve. We can't lose our nerve. And we do, I think, sometimes. We want to, not be so tough on them that we spark them to rebellion. And at the same time, we have to feel comfortable with what we allow. And so you do your homework. You make sure you know the friends. You make them, all that kind of thing happen. They're wheeling me out, so, or telling me to shut down. Thank you very much.